Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Tonight, I continue the second part to my Joe Satriani interview about his new album, The Elephants of Mars. Being a fellow New Yorker, I had to ask him about the track East 104th Street, New York City, 1973, because I was there.
Between 1st and 2nd Avenue, that's where my father was born and raised. And so in the 60s, when I was a real little kid, I'd go there, you know, every Sunday. I'd play out on the street. You know what that neighborhood was like back then. When you're a little kid, you don't notice how weird or dangerous it is, you know. But in the 70s, I was a, you know, 14-year-old young musician, and I started to become aware that, oh, my God, this city's in tatters, and this is a crazy place. I can't believe I've been playing out on the street. My grandmother was still there. She refused to move. You would know this, that in the 70s, actually in around 1980, first time I brought my wife there, that address only had one building occupied, which was the building my grandmother was in. And there was only her and one other tenant. Every other building was empty and destroyed and destitute. You know, there was a school like catty corner from her apartment. And I remember when I brought my wife there, there was a burnt out car somehow had gotten into the outdoors entryway to the school. I mean, it was like you were walking into some World War II footage, you know, of Eastern Europe. You know, it was just like, what happened to this place where the landlords all just skipped town? You know, my grandmother was in her 90s and she just refused to move. And there's nothing my father or his brothers could do to get her to move. And, you know, God bless her. You know, she was from the old country and she was wonderfully stubborn that way. By the time the 70s were over, I had moved to the San Francisco area. But I had fond memories of being the clueless little kid playing on those streets with my cousins. And, you know, everything was just about games and going to the candy store around the block, you know? Yeah. So I just picked that date, you know, just, and then of course my experiences in the early and mid 70s as a musician, you know, I mean, I'd see like Led Zeppelin at the Garden and I'd see John McLaughlin at Central Park and just everything in between. The city was just a great place for music and rock and jazz and fusion and soul and funk and the beginnings of hip hop and punk. It was all there. You know, I left in about around 78 for good. And when I returned, I was playing with Mick Jagger. So it was kind of weird. I saw an entirely different Manhattan, you know, staying at the Mayflower Hotel. And just like, I thought, this is not the New York City I remember. You're like, like, where have I been? You know, oh, that's right. This is a whole different society, you know, that occupies this part of the city. And I just never knew it. I just only knew Spanish Harlem, you know. And it was great because, you know, that was where my father grew up. And of course, he knew the whole city. He went to City College and he was able to, you know, achieve the American dream. But that was his home turf, you know, and it was great to, as I grew older, to make that connection, you know, that he'd been all over the city. He'd gone swimming in the East River as a kid and he had just crazy adventures and he saw all the great swing bands. So you pay a nickel, get a beer and watch the greatest swing bands and clubs all over the city. I loved growing up on Long Island. One thing that's really cool about the suburbs is that there are garages and that's where garage bands come from. You know what I mean? It's a very different vibe. That's why the really great bands, they really do come from the suburbs, you know, because kids need space to play somewhere. That's the phenomena, you know. And of course, you know, we were, what, back then, 30 minutes. I could take a bus to Jamaica Station, jump on the subway, or catch a ride with a friend. And so we were always in the city. So besides visiting the relatives that were spread out between Manhattan and the Bronx. So, yeah, it was a great place. And of course, you got Long Island's got the beaches. But it's a funny place. I mean, every place is a funny place to grow up. But I look back with fond memories because I realize now as a grown up that my parents were just young city kids that worked hard and made a family, you know, and raised me. And I feel blessed, you know. I remember being in bands back then, and you know, the clubs would close at four. So if you worked in a band at a club, you were doing, you know, four or five sets. You'd start at 10:30 at night and you'd finish at four. And so the doors would close and you'd find yourself sitting on stage with a drink and a cigarette, totally wasted with your friends, and someone would start playing. You'd have a jam of some kind. And so that was the vibe I was in, really sort of relaxed performance to it. It was a one take performance that I just, you know, this is kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, because I was in a home studio and there was no clock on the wall. I could, you know, encourage myself to get into these moods and then record those moments of being a natural musician rather than, you know, following something that was written on a page in front of me and trying to get it done before 3:20 p.m., you know. And so these kind of performances are one of a kind. And thank God we got them recorded and they're released. I mean, it is a discipline that you need to exercise every day that you walk into your home studio. You have to say, I got to get something done, you know. But at the same time, you can, even though it seems counter to that, you have to learn to accept that all your hard work can be worthless. There's nothing anywhere that says that hard work is always the best, or the thing that you spent the most amount of time is the best. There really is no rule. It's a cruel reality of art in general, that sometimes when you're not trying, you do your best. And when you're trying, you do your worst. The reality of it. Every time I play, I have no control over that. So I'm not saying that I've mastered it. I'm just saying that I recognize it. It's a thing. But I keep my ear open. And if I record something that's good and I haven't done a lot of work on it, I still respect it. You know, I've had the benefit of experience, you know, watching that happen, not only with myself, but when I'm producing another musician, let's say, for a session. We were doing the What Happens Next record. Glenn Hughes, you know, the bass player, had never been hired for an instrumental record in his entire career. He's an unbelievable singer and bass player. But he was just laughing half the time, like, I can't believe all I do is play bass. Like, you don't need me to sing, you know, it's so weird. So while we were playing, I could hear him, like, singing things. Like, every time there was, like, a little hole that I had left, you know, for, like, maybe a guitar little scrape or something like that, you know, I'd hear him go, do-do-do-do-do, you know, singing that great voice that he has. And so I started to write him down. I didn't say anything about it. I'd just be sitting there, you know, in the corner of the room, and I'd hear him sing something and I'd just sort of jot it down and musically and make a note, like, in this song at this measure, Glenn sang this, you know? So when he finished with all his bass parts, I said, okay, I got the craziest request, Glenn. I said, I've written all these little improvs down that you've been doing for the past 10 days. How would you feel about playing them on your bass? And he was like, what? And I said, yeah. I said, you sang this, you know, in the middle of, you know, Super Funky Badass, when there was a drum break and stop, and where normally there's a guitar bit, I heard you sing this. You were going like, oh, baby, baby, whatever. I said, what if you played that on the bass? And he listened to me sing it, and they went, okay. And then he played it on the bass, and we recorded it, and there it is. It was like a way of getting more Glenn on the album, you know, without him thinking it had to come from his fingers, you know what I mean? Once he realized that it was something that was coming from his natural voice, he jumped all over it. It was great. And it's almost on every song, there are little bass bits from me observing him when he wasn't thinking. You know what I mean?
That's a great story about Glenn Hughes. And it's really true. Most people hire him as a singer, not a bass player. So it's really cool that Joe had that experience. Now he explains about the song Sailing the Seas of Ganymede and recording in today's world.
Yeah, that song got kicked around quite a bit because the story is really twisted. It goes all the way back to me doing the Jimmy Fallon show a few times. And each time, you know, you get led into this teeny room that is way too small for a great band like the Roots, and really too small for like one of the greatest drummers of all time, Questlove. But it's really comical. You can barely open the door and fit in, and they're all shoved in there. And that's where they rehearse before the show. And, you know, I'd done just about every late night show, and everybody has a big room. So this was humorous to me. It was almost like it was a SNL skit, you know, that they would be forced to do this. And so after the second time I played, I remember flying home and I'm thinking, where should Questlove be? Like, where is his rightful place in the universe? And I thought, he deserves a big sailing ship, and he deserves to be going on an epic adventure on some gigantic ocean with 300-foot cresting waves and, you know, commanding this big vessel. That's the kind of person he is. And then I made a note of it, and I got home and I started thinking, like, what would that sound like? That's so funny, you know, like a cartoon almost, you know. And then I thought, he's got to be somewhere more interesting than just like the Pacific Ocean or something like that. So I read somewhere the scientists were speculating there might be underground oceans on the moon Ganymede, which is a moon of Jupiter. And I thought, oh, that's where Questlove needs to be. That's where I'm going to imagine him. And then, I use that as my artistic license to create this epic sounding track. Again, as I explained it to everybody, you know, they would all find it very humorous, but they would use the idea of the song as a kind of a springboard for some of their crazier performance ideas. And that really helped the song really expand and become as interesting as it finally did. I've never felt comfortable, like if somebody came to me and said, you know, I need a song 120 beats per minute, make sure the chorus happens and, you know, at 50 seconds, and the solo should be no longer than 8 bars and blah, you know. I know there are people who are so great at writing songs and they're very successful at it. I tend to need a reason, a story, you know. I've had some luck, you know, not getting too crazy with writing with Sammy. But when you sit down and write with Sammy Hagar, he's such a character. He himself is, you know, providing you with source material. And we were talking about how songs that he likes where the band stops and the singer gets to sing. And we were like going through our catalog in our minds, like how many great songs are like that, blues songs, rock songs. But just watching him get so animated about it, it gave me an idea. And I came back with the song Soap on a Rope. But I didn't call it Soap on a Rope. I just did the whole demo and I showed the band and I said, how about this? I said, this is like, I'm thinking about you and that, and you on stage and, you know, that whole thing you were talking about. And he was so excited, and we recorded it like within an hour, it was done. Pretty amazing how that stuff can work. But when you've got a band and everyone is contributing and excited about something, it's just the opposite of what I just did, you know, taking months to record at home. The Chickenfoot things were done. You know, we'd do 3 songs in 2 days, and that would be it. And then we wouldn't see each other for 2 months. And then we'd do it, you know, we'd do another 3 songs when we met up again. So there's no rules or methods that really are the only way to do it, you know.
Yeah, that is so cool to write with Sammy Hagar. It must keep you on your toes all of the time, just with all his animation and energy. Now he tells me about his future tour that's going to start at the end of the year and his incredible Crystal Planet comic books.
Yeah, this is so unique that we're going to hit the road in September with 2 albums to represent live. I just, you know, it's really hard, which is why we're doing evening with concerts. So there won't be any opening band. The fans will get to hear play more songs from our catalog and new songs than ever before. Yes, Brian Beller on bass and Kenny Aronoff on drums and Ray Thistlethwaite will be playing keyboards and rhythm guitar. We're starting last week, I think, of September in North America. And we go for about 8 or 9 weeks. We'll finish right around Thanksgiving. And then we will start up again in Europe in, I think it's April 1st. The tour that we had to postpone 3 times. but it's happening. And that one finishes up, I think, mid-June of 23. Yeah, the world is, as you know, it just keeps getting crazier. So I almost, you know, I flinch in a way when people say, what are your plans? I go, plans? Oh, my God, who makes plans? I'm holding of the issues right now. And my good friend, Nicholas Del Drago, who's a airbrush artist, is just finishing up the third guitar that looks very much like issue number three, episode number three. And so we're moving forward. We should have the graphic novel out by the end of the year. All of these comic books that come out through Incendium and Opus, we have plans to keep this going to get three graphic novels out. So this is going to be something that's going on for quite a few years. The ones I'm holding right now have the great holographic collector's item covers and everything, but you can get the regular issues in any comic book store now. I think they're being sold just about everywhere in retail. I think we started out only online, and then we moved into general retail. It's kind of like with books, you know, you put out a hardcover and then it goes into paperback, suddenly it really explodes. And that's what happened to my Strange Beautiful Music, my memoir, when it went into paperback. So it's always a moment of celebration, because if it goes to paperback, that means it's selling. The fact that the Crystal Planet is now in comic book stores is great. That means it's selling. And I really want to turn it into a movie, of course. I just think it's a fantastic movie, epic adventure. It could stand up to Star Wars. You know, it's just such a fantastic story. In this industry, you're always approaching everybody with all your stories. You know, it's not unlike the music industry, where you go on stage every night and you play that song again, hoping that, you know, it will ignite the passions of more people. So I remember reading once that baseball was a game of failure, and I always thought that was a great statement. But I think that the music business is truly a game of failure. When, you know, Ned and I started writing this like 7-8 years ago, along the way, we started out thinking it was going to be an animated TV show. So we just did video demos. And then as we would meet other talented people in the industry, we'd get advice about what we might try doing. I remember John Sayles was telling us, you guys should do a script for an action, live action movie. Try writing a novel. Try writing a comic book. See what happens to your story when you turn it into some other form, when you apply it to some other media, type of media. And it was a great exercise. And Ned, my partner, wound up creating what we call the Bible, which is the novel version of the story. And then we wrote several other versions. We did like how would we change the story if it was a stop action film, you know, with clay figures? How would we change the story if it was pure animation? And actually, we brought in Brendan Small from Metalocalypse to help us turn the script into something that would work. And Heavy Metal Magazine actually published Brendan's first script, which we called our pilot. Eventually, we wound up making a deal with Incendium and Opus and Heavy Metal, because a friend of mine, Lexi, who had created the Incendium Eternal Descent comic book series, was working at Heavy Metal Magazine at the time and was watching Crystal Planet sort of go through its stages. And when he wound up in a position to make a difference, he went to the owners and said, this is the project we should be doing right now. This has legs, you know. So Lexi, who's based in London with his company Incendium, then took it upon themselves to receive all this information that Ned and I had built up. And we had my artwork, all the scripts from Ned and from Brendan, Ned's novel. And they basically had to spend months reading through all this material, looking at the artwork. And then Lexi put together a team of great artists and storytellers to sort of create the comic book version of the story. So it really is a trip when you see people run with something that you've written. And I remember this one scene that we had in one of our demos where we took a shot of Keanu Reeves sitting on a park bench looking really sad and everything. And we used it as this moment to describe the feeling of our main character. And that's all you needed, you know. But if that's a page in a comic book, you need a lot more. The art of creating a great page in a comic book really has to do with what you include, what you don't include, the line drawings, the coloring, and just those very few words that are going to sit inside that little cloud, you know? And so you need people who do this day in and day out, you know, for a living, and are passionate about turning stories into comic book stories. And it's sort of like when you have a novel and you give it to a script writer, turning it into a script for a play or turning it into a script for a TV show or a movie, three totally different things. It's the same with going from Ned's novel version of Crystal Planet and turning into a comic book that makes sense. The whole design of the package is Todd Galapo and his company, Meat and Potatoes. I've known Todd for over 10 years. He did all the Chickenfoot stuff. You know, his company does stuff for, you know, Cabo Wabo and Beach Bar Rum. And he does stuff for musicians, actors, product manufacturers of all kind. He's done a lot of my album covers, and it's always great to work with him. The record company said they wanted to include some kind of artistic element for me in the package. And, you know, I have a commission with the Wentworth Gallery to produce original artworks on canvas and guitar. And so we couldn't really use any of that stuff because I was kind of under, you know, contract to, you know, and commission to create these works for sale in the galleries, which is an ongoing thing right now. What I think Todd was looking for was some sort of in-between that would artistically express the meanings of the songs, but in a very mysterious way. So I sent him all the pictures of all my artwork, and he really zeroed in on this series I had done, mixed media pieces with the art collective Scene 4, which were prints of me being photographed in the dark with LED light gloves, and then they render the photographs with some of my earlier artworks. They produce the print, send it to me, and then I paint on top of it. Very involved process. One of the things that he really liked was this sort of alien writing that I was doing on, you know, 10 or 15 of these pieces. And so he zeroed in on different sort of semi-hieroglyphic looking things to represent the different songs. And the way that he did it is he said, send me a paragraph about each song, about what the meaning is, and then I'll focus on each song and try to find one of your hieroglyphs that to me is in a funny way represents that. And that's how we wound up with those drawings.
Man, Joe is a guy after my own heart. He stays busy with everything. He's got comic books. He's got an art gallery exhibit. He's a true artist in many facets. Now he goes on to tell me what kind of gear and guitars he used in recording the album.
Most of the guitar tracks were done on maybe about three or four of my JS guitars. You know, the chrome one, the red one. Couple of prototypes that pretty much are the same. They just have different finishes on them. And then, you know, I used my signature acoustic along with a Martin acoustic, and I had a Jerry Jones sitar, you know, electric sitar. Those are funny instruments, you know, but, you know, you blend them in, they say a lot. You hit one note, everyone goes, oh, sitar, you know. You have to be careful with that, you know. I have a 7-string JS prototype that never went into production. And I always bring that out when I'm playing. I think there's 3 songs where I'm using the 7-string. It was quite a surprise that I wound up using the Sans amp. I really didn't think about that. It's the original one. I think it's from the 90s. I think it just comes with Pro Tools. It is a fantastic plugin in that it seems to really capture what's happening between your fingertip and the string. You know, it's really unique that way. And, I should say that the guys who mixed the record, you know, Eric and Greg Collard, they took those tracks out that I printed. They wound up putting them through like Les Paul's original LA-2A Fairchilds. I think he has 8 Fairchilds. They benefited from, you know, that beautiful big analog outboard gear. Definitely sounded way better on the mixes than were coming through my Pro Tools system. But that actually, that's a really good a recommendation for the plugin, because it means that there's a lot of information there. You know, you can't, there's the one thing about recording is that you can't really add information if it's not there. You know what I mean? In other words, you can't exaggerate a frequency if the frequency was never captured to begin with. Yeah. So that means that every time that they were able to make a super clean or mildly crunchy or super dirty Sans amp guitar sound really big, that means that the information was there, and that's a credit to that plugin. it is incredibly rich. It just takes some time to tweak it. You know, you got to be patient and learn how to use it. I've been doing it since the late 90s. We've been using it on albums here and there. So the whole process of recording DI and then changing your guitar sound as new tracks come in is so intuitive. You know, as a guitar player, you know that when you're just sitting down and you've got a Fender Princeton and a couple of pedals, you go, oh, this is all I got, you know? And you don't know what during the overdub set, like what if they bring in, you know, flutes and taiko drums and, you know, suddenly your Princeton is shrinking and you go, I should have brought the high watt, damn, you know? At least when you record DI that you can go, wow, I can actually, you know, pull up a high watt plugin on my, you know, Amplitude 5 or, you know, whatever plugins or modeling suites you like, you have this ability to go from Vox to Fender to Marshall to high watt to PV, whatever it is, and respond to how a track is changing as it gets produced, you know. Even if you had the same guitar on and you go through all these different modeling suites, you know, you're not going to play like a Eddie Van Halen style Marshall 100 watt model like you would an AC30. Strings feel different. I mean, you're just like, oh, okay, that won't work.
That's wild, because I never would have believed that he recorded the whole album on a Sansam plugin. That just really blows me away. And I used to have the original one of those in the 90s. And a funny story, because I took that Sansam to London to work with Ernie McCone in the studio for my album Last Kiss Goodbye on Instinct Records. And it was a great sounding box. Now here is East 104th Street, New York City, 1973. Thank you.
This is Joe Satriani, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT, home of the best guitar instrumentals.
That's Joe Satriani, a new one called Pumpin'. Before that was another new one, Sailing the Seas of Ganymede, from his new album, The Elephants of Mars. It's a great track.